This is take number two, Harry Conger, December 9th, 1999.
We were talking about your jobs, and I was wondering what sort of jobs Phyllis might have had.
Phyllis worked all of her adult life. Certainly during the years when we were in late grade school and high school, she babysat when she was a younger girl. Mm-hmm. But by the time we got to high school, she worked every afternoon and on weekends in the local drugstore. And so she must have worked 15 or 20 hours a week when we were in high school, all that time. And of course the druggist was a very good, very good friend of ours, whom we kept in touch with for years after we left town. Mm-hmm. So she did that. And then our strategy was, Phyllis and mine, that we'd get married when we got out of high school. And this was sort of a shock to her. It was my idea that we do that, because I knew I was leaving town and I didn't want to leave her behind. So I said, look, let's get married and we'll work my way through school. And then when I get through school, then you can be a housewife and stay at home and take care of the kids. And so she agreed to that. So we did. Two months after we graduated from high school, we got married.
In the church in Yakima.
In Yakima, mm-hmm. In St. Michael's.
Were your families all...
Yeah, well, they were sort of shaking their heads and saying, gee, you know, you guys are awfully young. Why don't you just go to school? And my folks couldn't afford to send me to school, so I needed some way to finance that. And certainly, I come from a small school like I did with the grades I had. There's no way I was going to get any scholarships. I was not deserving of any. So at any rate, they were sort of shocked at that, but Mom just picked up on that immediately and said, okay, if that's what you're going to do, we support that. And so she had a reception to introduce Phyllis to all of the family.
Before?
From Seattle, yeah, before the wedding and all of that. And that was really nice. And so the aunts and uncles all came from Seattle and from Yakima and from, I think we had relatives up in Cleello, near the coal mines at that time too, and they came down. So
what was the name of that?
Cleello, which is just a small town near the coal mines up on in the Snoqualmie Pass area. So anyhow, they all, and that was so neat of Mom to do that. So she bought off on that. And so then Phyllis and I was working in a cannery that summer nearby. And so anyhow, we were stacking up money, both of us, to move to Seattle for me to start school and for her to get a job. And that was tough for her to find a job. Boy, she was on the pavement every day for 4 or 5 months trying to find a job. And finally, she did at an insurance company.
I want to know about your wedding. I'm curious.
Oh, my wedding. Our wedding.
Your wedding, right.
It was at St. Michael's Church. I think Phyllis wore Mom's wedding dress. And, you know, they had altered some, because Mom was quite a bit taller than Phyllis. I'm pretty sure it was. It was not new. It was not a new wedding gown. So anyhow, they did that. My recollection is it was a little yellow, you know, from age, because it would have been, what, 20, 25 years old or something like that, or more. How old was I? Yeah.
Well, you were
20, about 25 years old.
About 18.
Yeah. Yeah, and anyhow, it was over 20 years old. But it was, my recollection, it was a little bit young. But we didn't notice.
No.
So we had the wedding and church, and then the reception right next door in the parish house. Mm-hmm. And
now you were both, were you both 18?
I had just turned 19.
I was wondering if you had to go through any legal.
No, and she was 18, and I had just turned 19. I don't think we. I really don't recall. Maybe Mom had to sign for me. I just don't recall that.
Would guess if you were both over 18 that you would be adults.
But back in those days, maybe it was older. But mm-hmm. in any case, there was no problem with that. No. Whether we had to do that or not, I had to have our parents sign.
Did you have attendance?
Yep. My best man was my cousin, Archie. Mm-hmm. And then some of the guys I went to high school with were the ushers. Rosemary. Mm-hmm. Phyllis, who was her maid of honor? One of her close friends.
Didn't have sisters.
Yes, she did.
Yes, oh, of course she did. Yes.
She had four sisters.
Right.
Well, maybe Gloria, her youngest sister. You've met Gloria.
She had a sister she was very close to.
Yeah,
I remember
Gloria,
that.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And maybe
yeah.
she was. I just
well,
sort of forget that.
Well, it doesn't matter,
yeah.
but anyway, I was...
Anyhow, it was, mm-hmm. it was a, you know...
You didn't run off from...
No, we didn't elope.
No.
It was a real wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, for our honeymoon, we went up... I had a car. I had an old 29 DeSoto by this time. But that wasn't very snappy. So Dad said, well, why don't you take my car? He had a 1941 Plymouth. He said, you guys can take my car. I said, oh, okay, gee, that's great. So we took that and we went up to Lake Chelan, which is on the Columbia River, just north of Wenatchee. And that's where another guy and I, a high school friend, used to go for two summers, and we batched up there and worked in this guy's apple ranch and did all his grunt work on his ranch, and we batched. So that's where Phyllis and I went on our honeymoon, not to the ranch, but to a motel in Lake uh-huh. Chelan, which is right on this beautiful lake.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we went on our honeymoon. And I remember that first night, we drove as far as Wenatchee. And it was about 9 or 10 o'clock at night by the time we got there. And we were going to the hotel to register. And I don't think I had thought to make a reservation. Didn't know much about those things in those days. But that was no problem. He had a room, but he was looking at us as we were just too young to be.
Mm-hmm.
And Phyllis had a straw hat on. And so, well, I was saying that we wanted a room with a double bed. Mm-hmm. The guy's looking at me, and Phyllis turned her head a little bit, and rice fell out of her straw hat. And so then he said, oh, okay. Because he could, you know, tell that we had just gotten married.
That you were
yeah,
married.
Yeah. But he wasn't sure he was going to let us have a room. So anyhow, that's where we went on.
So then this was in, you said August.
August of 49. Yeah.
And then you went to Seattle.
Then we went to Seattle, and she really had to work hard to find a job. But did, and got on with an insurance company, and she took the raw data from applicants for insurance and then put it onto their forms and, you know, typed it all on there, processed these things. And so she worked there for 2 years, I guess. Yeah, 2 years. And
you were in school.
And I was going to school, and I was working part-time. Summers I worked at the sawmill that my grandfather, years and years before, put that money into. Now the cousins were running it. And so I worked out there at the sawmill in the summertime. Then in winters, the rest of the school year, I got a job at a four-tile warehouse. And it was an Oakland-based company.
Oh.
E.F. Heine Floor Supplies was the name of the outfit.
What's the name?
Heine, H-E-I-N-E.
Huh.
They were headquartered here in Oakland. And they had a warehouse up there. And they'd get floor tiles and stuff and linoleum and all of those floor products. And I worked out in the warehouse just stacking the stuff and loading trucks. And I could work whenever I wanted to. So.
Oh.
As soon as you know, I was through with class, I'd go down there in the afternoon, and I'd work till 6 or 7 at night.
How much were you paid?
Oh, I bet it wasn't more than 70 or 80 cents an hour, something like that. But
no benefits.
Oh no. So I did that while we were in Seattle. Work for those two different things. And then when we moved to Colorado, when I transferred, she got a job initially at City Hall, and quickly got a job there. It was in January when we moved there too, and that was sort of funny. We loaded up everything we owned in this, and we had just bought this secondhand car, a 39 Chevy sedan. So we loaded it. It carried everything we owned, you know, but you could hardly see out the back window. But so we drove across Idaho and Wyoming down to Denver through the dead of winter, and happily we made it all okay. Didn't get caught in a storm or anything. But when we got to Golden, we went to this motel. And the next day I went to see the dean of students about enrolling. I had been there before and talked to them, and then went back to Seattle and went for a couple more semesters at the University of Washington. And then we moved. And so now it's the second time I'm seeing this guy, and so he's showing me what I'm getting in the way of credits to transfer. And I was so discouraged. I went after being with him for a couple hours. I went back to the motel where Phyllis was, and I said, "Don't unpack anymore. We're going back home. They're just not going to give us enough credit." She said, "I'm not getting back in that car for anything." After coming across here and all the work we've gone to, we're not leaving. So I said, "Okay, okay." Mm-hmm. So we did. So we stayed.
Good.
Yeah, but she then quickly got a job at City Hall, and one of her co-workers turned out and is still one of my dear friends, Bonnie Kroger. She was married to a guy named Ray, who worked at Coors Brewery. Ray did, worked in the bottle shop. Anyhow, she and Bonnie became fast friends, and then the four of us became fast friends. So one day, Bonnie and Phyllis, this guy they were working for was really not a very good person. He was just a screwball. So the two of them got fed up with him one day, and they said, "Let's go down to Coors and see if we can't get a job down there." And because that's the biggest thing in the whole county. And they went down there, and sure enough, they both got jobs.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, just boom. And so they both went to work down there. And Phyllis was the receptionist and the secretary of Ab Coors, one of the sons. There were three sons by this time. They're running the business. And of course, Phyllis had no secretarial skills, and nothing like Rosemary, who trained to be a secretary and could take shorthand, just zip, 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 type 400 words a minute, and all that. Phyllis had none of that, but she had a lot of personality and got the chance to learn that. And so she was a receptionist and, of course, secretary. because the office was that small. And those, all three of the brothers were right there in this office together. Okay. And there were Phyllis and two other girls in there, I think. So anyhow, so she worked for them all the while.
Great job.
I was going, great job, and great people. And Bill, of course, to this day, is a dear friend of mine. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we see each other often. And mm-hmm. and he remembers when Phyllis used to work there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just a great relationship. And we were so lucky to have that, because she had wonderful pay, you know, and benefits.
How much did they pay? Do you remember?
I couldn't tell.
I keep asking this.
Yeah,
it's important.
Yeah, it is important, and I can't tell you. I know, and I worked too part time, and during summers down at the experimental plant that the school had, and I do remember that. That was 85 cents an hour I was getting mm-hmm. for that, no overtime, but 85 cents an hour, and I could work as much there as I wanted. So I spent a lot of time down there, and between the two of us, we made enough money to for me to go to school and for us to live. And, it was okay. Mm-hmm. We had enough.
Was there student housing?
No, not for us. There was, that was right after the war, and there was student housing for the GIs, and there was a park just very near. We rented this little house we rented, one-room house, right on the edge of the campus. And they were right across Ford Street in these barracks that were set up mm-hmm. during the war for military personnel. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they left, so they gave the school, acquired them, and vets could stay there. So all of our friends, most of my classmates were vets.
Mm-hmm.
They all lived over there, but we had to rent a house. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, we made enough money that we got by very comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, Phyllis working at these jobs was the core of our money to live on.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to make enough money to pay for the schooling and everything, but she really made the contribution to our welfare.
And I must say, I think, you know, I've heard so many stories, had so many friends that did this, and then as soon as the husband got his degree, found somebody else and dumped the wife that put him through school. It's wonderful to hear a story where you started out and stuck with it. And it was certainly a wonderful marriage.
Yeah, it was. You know, I've been so lucky all my life. But Phyllis, you know, had to be the luckiest thing that ever happened to me.
A lot of people got put through school by their wives and then didn't remember it later.
Yeah.
I was looking here to see. I don't think you didn't say anything in the earlier interview about how you got... Why you went to CSM? What made you interested in getting into mining? And what were you studying at Washington?
I enrolled in Washington Engineering. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the first 2 years, it's all the same anyhow, except for a couple of electives.
Mm-hmm.
All the same subjects. So there was no immediate pressure right after I went there to declare a major.
Did you have any anticipation of that?
I really didn't initially. And as I mentioned to you, my uncle, his father discovered, it was one of four guys that discovered this coal mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd never been to their coal mine. I'd never seen it. Mm-hmm. Didn't know anything about coal mining.
You knew that people that sold gold bricks weren't very...
Well, that never entered my head, because I don't think this guy was a miner anyhow. He was a promoter. But after I got to Washington, enrolled and was starting to take these courses, immediately realizing how much I was going to have to scramble to to catch up with these guys that were from the large schools in Seattle and the other cities in the state. But it's at some point in there, and it was probably my uncle's coal mine that first twigged this. And he was investing some money in some new equipment for the coal mine. This is after the war. John L. Lewis was giving mine operators the opportunity to invest in new equipment if they would pay his miners more money. In other words, equipment replaced men. And he would allow that as long as the men got more money that were kept. And which is one of the smartest things any labor leader ever did, because the coal industry in the U.S., because of that, grew tremendously, and the price of coal every year during his tenure went down. It cost less and less and less. Even though his miners were making more and more, there were fewer of them making more and more.
More productive.
But the people that bought the coal, the people that use electricity, all benefited from this. And so my uncle, and I didn't know this at the time, this is looking back on it now, but he obviously was taken by that opportunity to invest in capital to replace people and produce more coal at less cost. So he was doing that, and once in a while he'd be over in Seattle, and we'd see each other, and he'd be telling me about this. And I think that's probably what got me to thinking about mining. Not coal mining, but just mining. And so then I started looking into it a little bit. Well, what does that involve? And the thing that intrigued me most as I looked into it was that mining engineers got to do all kinds of engineering. Is electrical, mechanical, geologic, and then all of the mine infrastructure itself, each of which involves engineering one way or another. You don't even try to put a description on. But you got to work with people and actually out doing something. And I'd always done that. I'd always been working with my hands, but out with people who worked with their hands. And I like that. And so that just seemed so much better than sitting in an office somewhere drafting or calculating or any of that stuff. So that as time went on, that really became appealing. And then in that first year or two, I actually got to go to a mine up in British Columbia, the Cominco's Trail Mine. Kimberley, B.C. Not Trail, that's where the smelter was. The Sullivan Mine in Kimberley. And got to go underground. Well, that did it. That was so fascinating to see what they did and what was involved in it. That really tilted the scale for me. And from then on, that's what I wanted to do. As it turns out, and the question was what caused you to go to Colorado? As it turns out, by now I'm a sophomore at Washington, starting to take some mining courses. And there were, I think, four of us or so in the class, in my class. And that was a spring quarter, and so then we left. We all worked during the summer. Came back in the fall. My other three buddies left. One guy dropped out of school. The other two guys transferred to another school. And so I was now the class, the mining engineer class. And I thought, well, this is not going to get a lot out of that experience. And so that's when I decided, I need to go someplace where there are a lot more people taking this course than me. And so I looked at the various schools, and of course Colorado has always had sort of a high profile, so that was one that I looked at early on and corresponded with them. And in the early days, I didn't realize how much of a haircut I was going to take in transferring, but mm-hmm. but that's what got me interested. And then that following summer, I had a job down in the Four Corners area, drilling for working on a drill rig.
Oh, really?
Drilling for uranium. And
who were you working for?
Well, it was actually it was for Joy Manufacturing. It was their rig, and I was going to go down there just as a swamper on the rig. So anyhow, on the way down to the Four Corners, I went through Denver and went out to the school and talked to the dean of admissions and, you know, what could I do and so forth. And he wasn't nearly as specific as my second visit, when they actually said, okay, we'll give you credit for this, we won't give you credit for that, and so on. And so it all sounded pretty doable on that first visit. But at any rate, that's what started the process of me transferring there. And then that January, I transferred mm-hmm. and started the second semester. Colorado was on semester system, and the University of Washington was on quarters.
Oh,
so I had taken the courses, but I didn't have enough hours mm-hmm. in the courses, because to add up quarters, a full year, it adds up. Two semesters or three quarters, they add up.
Mm-hmm.
But any portion of those don't add up. And so I wound up having to take physics again, one semester of it, only because I didn't have enough hours. I had the course, and they said, well, you can take either the first semester or the second semester. It doesn't make any difference. Whatever you want to study, you can take that again, because you just need the hours. So.
Oh.
So anyhow, and then all through the time I was going to Colorado, because I was so out of step with everybody, I had to have a prerequisite for this, to take this, but it wasn't offered in this quarter or semester. So I had to work through all that, but it all worked out. I had some semesters that had pretty heavy hours to get it all in, but I wanted to get out and get to work. Mm-hmm. So,
must have been very highly motivated at that point.
Highly motivated to get to work, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To get out and do something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's how that came about.
And you worked at the experiment station mm-hmm. there on the campus, you said.
Yeah. And most of that was metallurgical test work.
Mm-hmm.
Different ores would come in the lab there under contract would do flotation tests and so on. And the taconite industry was just getting going then. And that was a big project they had for at least a year that I was working there. Those magnetic separators were being perfected to separate the magnetite mineral from the waste rock magnetically. It was a mechanical problem. The theory worked great, but how to build these drums so that they first of all picked up the magnetite and then deposited in a continuous process. So anyhow, that was one of the big projects that was going on there. Another one did a lot of work on flotation for potash. There was a potash mineral called langbeinite that was low, very low grade.
And
langbeinite. And I'm not sure that I can spell it.
You can look it up.
Yeah. But at any rate, they were working on various flotation processes and other ways of separating the various salts. And so they came out with the phosphate, the potash that they were after. Not phosphate, potash. Anyhow, I worked there all the time that I was going to school, after school and then on weekends and during the summer.
Now, was this a U.S. Bureau of Mines?
No, it's Colorado School.
The only?
Yeah, the school.
The Colorado's independent station.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's right by the school.
Yeah. I guess it's still going, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Research institute?
Yes, but it's in other hands now, and it's physically moved. It used to be right on the edge of campus.
Mm-hmm.
It moved, must be 10 miles from campus now.
I think Hazen's business
is
was sort of in competition with it, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they were.
Superseded
yeah.
it
but,
in some
but
ways.
But Hazen started quite a while after I left.
Yes, yes.
Well, not too much.
But I think there
later.
Was a time when, well, people chose between Hazen or
yes.
Golden, and
yeah.
Hazen did so well. That
yeah,
maybe.
And they really did good work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Hazen was running then.
No,
but
wasn't.
it was some later, and they did compete, and then the school got out of the business, and some of the guys that worked for the school took the business and got some funding from somebody. I don't know where that came from, but it was pretty much that same group for some time.
I see. I was wondering how this, you know, there's so much interest now in university research and being independent and not funded by private industry or by government. You probably weren't aware of it at that time, but I was wondering, was this state government
no,
funding? Or
I don't think so. I think...
well, like the taconite, was this...
That was under contract to U.S. Steel or Cleveland-Cliffs or one of the companies.
Contract with an
independent... Yeah.
With
yeah, it was private.
Company.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm sure it was private. I don't think there was any government money in that. I wouldn't have known.
No.
But I can remember guys coming from the companies, you know, see what, you know, how's it coming, what kind of results you're getting.
Yeah.
And I personally wasn't keeping any records or anything. I was just doing the grunt work to keep that stuff running.
Mm-hmm.
But they would come and visit, and I never did see anybody that looked like they're from the government there. So I think it was private. I think it's private money.
Uh-huh.
And same with the potash.
Did this tie in? Did they make an effort to tie this in with your studies at all?
No. And I it was just you know, I could have been some guy off the street working there.
I see.
They gave preference to students to work there, but.
You were about to say that there was no connection.
No connection between the academic courses and working there. Now, some of the guys who were graduate students worked there and worked on projects as scientists and engineers.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be the closest to what you were asking. But as an undergraduate, no.
Mm-hmm.
No, there was no connection. Yeah. Strictly for money.
Did you make any personal contacts through people through this that would have helped you later? Did you?
No. No, not really. There were a couple of people that were associated with the center that were, you know, really well known in the industry. A couple of the guys that worked as graduate students there, I I kept in contact with it. It didn't, other than knowing them and seeing them at meetings and stuff,
mm-hmm.
it didn't do anything for my career, mm-hmm. Other than just knowing these people. We had worked together at the plant.
Mm-hmm.
They were graduates, scientists working there, mm-hmm. and I was a grunt, but we knew each other, and we would see each other at meetings. And one of the guys has passed away now, but he was very well known in the beneficiation of iron ores. And I've forgotten his name, unfortunately. The other guy is still alive, and I see every time I go to an AIME meeting or other mining meetings, Roshan Bapu.
Oh, yes.
You probably know him.
Mm-hmm.
But he worked there as a graduate student. So those are the only two that really come to mind.
Did you join AIME when you were there?
Yes, when I was a student, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did this play any part on the campus? Was it a...
It wasn't that active. We did have guest speakers come in to the student meetings once in a while, but it was not a really active thing. Most of us were pretty busy, just keeping everything going.
Now, did you have a WAMI scholarship?
I did from San Francisco, this section. And I also had an ASARCO scholarship.
Oh. How did you happen to get that?
Well, as you know, the schools have these scholarships, companies and organizations like WAMI's,
mm-hmm.
Advise schools that these scholarships are available for worthy students. And so I remember early on after I went to Colorado, my great hope was that after 6 months of living there and working, I would be a resident, and so I wouldn't have to pay non-resident tuition.
Mm-hmm.
They told me no, that I had to live there for a year without going to school before I'd become a resident.
Oh.
And so that was a sort of a shock. So anyhow, I was sort of counting on having lower tuition after the first semester.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could see that wasn't going to happen. So I did look at what the scholarship situation was. And so I applied for both of these and happily got both of them.
This was after you were already
after
there.
After I was there, yeah.
I see.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good.
So that was very helpful.
Now, the WAMI loan had to be repaid.
Yes, yeah.
Was the ASARCO loan also?
No. It was not a requirement to repay that.
Was it a requirement to go to work for them later?
No, I did. But not because I owed them anything,
I see.
Or that they expected me to. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, that was arm's length decision on their part and my part.
I see.
And so that was not a repayable scholarship. There was
a grant.
It was a gift.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was good.
Yeah.
Very good. And, so, and as it turns out, that was the best job offer that I had. That was in 55. Things were pretty good right then.
Yeah, I was trying to think what was going on. That was after the Korean War.
Yeah. Yeah, Korean War was just over.
That had given a boost to the... Yeah,
it was pretty good just then. Because
mm-hmm.
I remember I hired on
with a Sarco to go to Silver Bell. And it wasn't good enough that they, some of the guys, when they got a job, the company would let them go to the mine and see it before they hired on. So I'd heard that. So when I was interviewing with the Asarco guy, I said, well, you know, I'd like to go down and see the mine. He said, well, you can go see if you want to, but we're not going to see it. So I never went down to see it. But anyhow, I think the job offer was for $465 a month or something like that, which, you know, compared to what Phyllis and I had been making, that was wow. So by the time I got, and this is in the context of the industry was doing pretty good, by the time we got there, job offer was made maybe in May, and I had signed up to be there sometime in August, because we were going to go back up to Washington and see the folks and all that stuff before I went to work. And so when I got there in August, I was filling out the forms at Silver, went to Silver, filling out the forms, and the office manager said, oh, by the way, you put down $465 for your starting salary. We've just raised that. It's put down $485.
Wow.
I said, wow, how come? He said, well, we to get the right number of people we wanted to hire this year, we had to raise the rate. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to treat all of you the same. I said, well, hey, that's terrific. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say the industry is doing pretty well then. During that period. Now, 3 years later, it was really not doing well at all, 58, 59, but then it was.
You might tell about your introducing yourself. Was this the person that you introduced
When I went out to Silver Bell, this is a mine Asarco had, open pit mine, 45 miles north and west of Tucson. And to get out there, you had to drive across a desert valley. And as will happen in summertime, the summer storms can generate a lot of water, and this valley drained a huge area. Mm. So the day I was supposed to go out there and move out there, the valley was flooded and you couldn't get across the flood. So it was a day or so later, we had to stay in town for a day or so to get out there. So, but anyhow, when we got out there, I went to the office, which is a very small building, about four or five rooms. It was a permanent building, but quite small. And so I went into the reception area and said, gave my name, and I had an appointment at 2 o'clock with the manager, Mr. Purvis. And so they took me into his office in a few minutes, and that's when I said, hello, I said, I'm from the Colorado School of Mines. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, well, I'm from Socorro. And I realized that he'd be more interested in knowing my name than where I was from. At any rate, that was sort of an humbling experience that I needed. We got things on a good basis. But anyway, I started there as a junior mining engineer. Worked on ore reserves, surveyed in drill holes, all those kinds of things. For about a year. Actually, it was just almost a year, yeah, because that following summer in about June. I had taken ROTC in school and got a commission as a second lieutenant and had an obligation to serve 2 years in the service. And because the war was over now, the Korean War, and the military was being cut back, they didn't need the complement of officers that they had been taking. And so they offered a lot of us, if not all of us, that were in that same group, the opportunity to take 6 months of officer training, and then 7.5 years of being in the reserve. And so I was not a military person, and I said, that's great, I'll do that. And you had the option of doing the 2 years if you wanted to. I said, I'll do that. And so that the following, I went there in 55, and then in 56, I went to Silverville in 55, and then in 56, served that 6 months starting in the summer sometime. That would be in 56, 6 months, 4 months, or 3 months at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and then 3 months at Fort Lewis, Washington. And while I was doing that, and in the meantime, Red had been born. So Phyllis and Red was born in December. So while I was in the Army for that 6 months, Phyllis and Red went back to Washington. She stayed with her dad. And then when I went to Fort Lewis, she and I got an apartment right there in Tacoma while I was at Fort Lewis, and then back to Silverville later in 50, must have been 56, maybe that, by then it was 57.
See, Red was born December of...
5th of 55.
55.
Yeah.
Yeah, we hadn't mentioned the ROTC at Colorado, but that was another thing that took time.
Took time, but paid $27.50 a month.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was a very helpful component.
Motive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're right. It took.
You had mentioned the veterans' housing, but were the veterans? Well, how'd you feel about other veterans as students? Were they a lot older than you?
Yeah, they were. Because a lot of them were veterans from the Second World War.
Right.
Not the Korean War.
Second World War. They were still there.
So, yeah, these guys were 5 to 8 years older than I.
And knew what they wanted, I'm sure.
Sure, yeah, and had families. All of them had kids. So it was a different environment than you would expect. And I, because I was married, I fit mm-hmm. in with that group rather than the guys who were my age,
mm-hmm.
Who went to the belonged fraternities and so forth.
I was
more closely aligned with the veterans, the older.
Even though they were older.
Yeah.
Because you were married.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
And working so hard.
Exactly. So that was the group that we had most of the friends with.
You weren't doing a lot of partying, I imagine.
No. And they weren't either. None of us were. It was just the time that everybody was mm-hmm. putting into. Getting her education, and we'll do social stuff later.
So at Silverville then, when the first year that you were there, you were in the pit.
Yeah, in the office as an engineer, and surveying out in the field, the pit, mm-hmm. and the tailings dam, and all of those things. Just ore reserves in the office, you know, junior engineer stuff. And it was good. It reconfirmed my feelings that this isn't what I wanted to do for my lifetime, but I needed to do that to see what needed to be done and how it could be done. And then when I came back from the service, I worked on some projects, construction projects. I managed some small construction projects there at the mine. But what I was waiting for is to get a chance to go out in the mine and shift, get into management, line management. And so that didn't happen for, 4 or 5 months after I got back from the service, and I was really getting anxious to do that. And I forget what the circumstances were now, but a guy that had been a close friend of the guy that was the manager of mining for ASARCO back in New York. His name was Darwin Pope. Darwin's son and this guy were in the army together. And so when this guy got mustered out of the army, Darwin's son introduced him to his dad, and his dad got him a job out in Silverbell. And so he got the next shifted job that came open. Actually, it was a new, Silverbell was a new mine. It had only been running about 2 years or less by the time I got there. And it was ASARCO's first open pit mine. They had underground mines, but they didn't have any open pit mines. So this was their first open pit mine. So they hired a construction company to do the stripping and mining. And ASARCO people ran the plant and the rest of the facilities because they had been doing that for a long time. They knew all about that. Mm-hmm. But they had not run an open pit before.
Now, in spite of the name Silver, it was a copper mine, wasn't it?
It was a copper mine, yeah. Contradiction in terms. The initial stripping and the stripping and mining, ore mining, were done by Isbell Construction Company for the first 3+ years. And then ASARCO looked at the economics of that and decided a contract was about to expire with Isbell, decided to buy a mining equipment and do it themselves, which gave all of us a chance to get into production because the contractor was doing all of the production work and we just sort of monitor what they were doing. We didn't manage the crews or anything. So that opened up the shifting jobs, and that happened while I was in the Army. But they hadn't filled all of the jobs yet by the time I got back. So here I'm thinking, oh my golly, I ought to get one of these shifting jobs, because we had two pits and we operated day shift and swing shift. So there was the opportunity for 4 shifted jobs, 2 at each pit. And so the first crew went out and the senior guy got that one, and then the next senior guy got the next one, and so on. And anyhow, the fourth one, this friend of Darwin Pope's son shows up and he gets the fourth job. And I'm saying, oh, bummer. That's not good. So anyhow, I'm rattling around doing these projects and just sort of biding my time, but still watching all of this. And after a few months, this guy didn't turn out to be doing a very good job. And so they let him go. And then I got, mm-hmm. that gave me a chance to get out and shift.
And so justice wins.
No, not justice, it's, you know, it's where the things work out, but that was great. And I was doing what I wanted to do and where I wanted to do it. It's a great place. I learned the business right there.
What about your housing?
We had great housing. It was a great camp. They had built the houses up in Phoenix and brought them down on trailers. But ours was a, at first, when we were first there, we were in the bunk, not a bunkhouse, apartment houses. But then it wasn't too long before we got into a house. And our house initially was a two-bedroom house. And maybe 1,200 square feet, but it's certainly no more than that. They were small, but hardwood floors, bathroom, kitchen, carport, little storage room right off of the carport. They were really nice houses. And I told Phyllis when we were in school, because I'd been up to this mining camp up in Canada and had seen a little bit of what it's like out in the sticks. And so I was telling Phyllis for months after I took this job, before we went up, I said, you got to understand that we're going to be way out in the tulies, and it's probably not going to be very nice housing, but I'm sure we'll have an individual place to live. You know, we won't be in with other people, right, in the living quarters. But it's not going to be very nice, because that's what I thought it was going to be. They wouldn't let me go down and look at it beforehand. And we got there, and they showed us the bunkhouse, or not the bunkhouse, the apartment houses. There are three in a building, which are fine, but you got people on either side of you, and they're cockroaches. You know, they had to run through your place to get to their place, and you know what it's like. But we could see the houses, and they said, you know, when one comes vacant, you're next on the list. And so we got a house very shortly after that, and they were neat. And I had so conditioned Phyllis how bad it was going to be. She was in heaven. We had never, either of us, lived in a place any nicer than that.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so it was great, and it was a wonderful camp.
And Red was born?
Red was born
there.
Just after we, 5 months after we got
Company
there.
Company hospital? Or?
No. We had to go in Tucson. He was born in Tucson. His press was about a 45-minute drive. Mm-hmm. Nervous drive that night. But
did the company, what was your health care benefit?
Well,
did they have a doctor there at Silver Bay?
No, we didn't have a doctor. we had no medical facility there.
I see.
But, 99% of the time you could get in town in 45 minutes. And,
sure.
And none of us thought anything about it. We didn't have any telephones there.
Really?
There were two public phones in camp. And so you had to stand in line on holidays and stuff. You wanted to call anybody, you know, your family or anything, you had to stand in line, big queue, outside the two public telephones to call out of camp.
Huh.
Yeah. But it was a wonderful camp. About a third of the people were Hispanic, many of whom had worked for ASARCO for years and years over in New Mexico, or down in Patagonia, to trench mine, trench mine. It was an underground base metal mine. And they were longtime employees of ASARCO and good people. And you know, because you've lived and worked with them too. And it was just a nice, close camp. Everybody knew everybody and we all did everything together. There was no, you know, bosses row and all that stuff.
About how many people were living?
I guess we must have had, maybe 100 houses.
Size of okay.
Yeah. And that may be more than, it may have been 80 or something like that. But, and then we had bunkhouse for single guys and a mess hall and a rec building and a swimming pool and a ball diamond, one gas station, one grocery store. And that was it.
Were the things like the gas station and the grocery store company owned or
nope.
Private?
Private. You could charge it at the company store or at the store, and he could get his money directly from your paycheck. Mm-hmm. But a Jewish guy owned it. He became good friends of ours. He and his wife. We used to always tease him. He had the fattest thumbs you could ever. And I'd say, Fred, I know how your thumbs got so fat. And he'd say, yeah, how? And I'd say, you used to hold it down on the meat scale when you were weighing the meat. Anyhow, it was a great camp. Great place for the kids to grow up. The bad part about it was the long ride to school, 25 miles down into the valley. At Aver Valley in Marana. But a good school. Gosh, Red had great teachers there. And Press did too when he started. Just really good teachers. And we were so lucky that they got started with good teachers like that. Even though they had a long bus ride to get there,
when was Press born? Let's get
he was
that
born thing. In 58.
58.
In January of 58.
It's Preston, isn't it?
Preston. Mm-hmm. P-O-N, yeah.
Okay. So, well, that was a great
beginning.
So
that was a great camp. Mm-hmm. And we were there from 55, July, August of 55 until sometime in 64, maybe it's spring of 64, probably spring of 64.
5 years, roughly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And after that first year, I was shifting for the rest of the time. And as we said in this, because I reread that recently, I thought I'd shifted long enough and was looking for some other kind of opportunity. And there just wasn't anything available. I was offered a shifting job at a new mine the Sarco was starting up down in south of Tucson, the Mission Mine. But there was no company housing for that. The increase in salary was not enough to pay the difference between company housing and what I would have to do to live in Tucson. And when asked how long I might have to shift on there, because I'd already been shifting for about 5 years, they couldn't tell me because there was no other mines in the offing right then. Mm-hmm. So I elected to stay. It was my choice to stay at Silver Mine. But once you turn a company down, when they want you to do something, you should figure that you haven't played the game right, and you ought to do something else, which I did. It took quite a while to find something else. And I can't recall just exactly the economic conditions then, but it took a while. It took over a year, actually, after I decided I was going to leave. So at any rate, that's when I went over to Eagle Mountain. Got a job over there for me.
Did you ever consider going overseas with the Sarco?
They never offered that.
I didn't.
In school, I had heard, and then subsequently I watched this after I got out of school. You can get quite rapid advancement offshore, overseas.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to come back, you come back down again,
mm-hmm.
Into some lower situation. And so that was sort of a trap. Sort of trapped into staying offshore. And so I wouldn't have asked to go to one of the others. I did get an offer. Now that I've forgotten this, I get an offer to go down to Peru as a general foreman. Yeah, that's right.
Southern Peru?
Yeah, it must have been Southern Peru.
Must have been.
Yeah, so that did happen. That's just mm-hmm. coming back to me. I was offered a job down there, and I said, you know, I don't speak Spanish, not a lick of Spanish. And they said, yeah, well, the guy that we had lined up for this job spoke Spanish, but he didn't know anything about open pit mining. So we thought, well, we'll go the other way. And so I thought about that, but declined to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just remember exactly when that was. But
Tocopala was opening up about that time, I think.
Yeah, the first pit had just opened up, and mm-hmm. and the smelter was built by then.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case,
you didn't ever seriously consider that.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the reasons that I mentioned.
We're just about at the end of the tape.
Okay, let's finish
so,
the tape.
I think it's finished.
It is finished.
Right about now.
All right. Well, I didn't really think that I wanted to go far.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew that
you pretty well saw the handwriting on the wall with the sarco that you wanted to go.
I had written it on the wall, mm-hmm. My mind, by turning them down.
Right.
And so, in fairness to them and myself, I needed to go on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
But it took over a year to find it. And I interviewed Amex at one point. They had a job in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of rationalized, well, that's not quite overseas because it's a U.S. territory. But I can remember the whoever it was in their organization that interviewed people. He was sort of their chief engineer. I guess he was the chief engineer for the company out of New York. And so he was on his way to the West Coast. We'd written back and forth a couple times. And he was sort of interested. They were looking for people to staff this new copper mine in Puerto Rico. And so he stopped off in Tucson, and I met him at the airport. We visited for an hour or two. And I'd just been shifting all this time, and he was looking for